Max Bergman here. For more of the Asset Podcast, please go to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/assetpodcast. That's patreon.com/assetpodcast. You'll hear the full interviews with our roster of experts and analysts. You'll also get more exclusive content from the Asset team, like our interview with the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, our live event reacting to Robert Mueller's testimony, an upcoming episode following the mysterious trail of dead Russians around the 2016 election, and a whole lot more. Don't miss out. Sign up today at www.patreon.com/assetpodcast.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Previously on The Asset.
On July 25th, 2019, Trump had his now infamous phone call with the newly elected Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky. This call came 7 days after the Trump administration had decided to withhold aid to Ukraine.
And I'm not just angry for you. I'm angry for every single foreign service officer, for every single military officer, for every intelligence officer who right now might believe that a lifetime of service and sacrifice and excellence might be ignored by the President of the United States, or worse yet, attacked in language that would embarrass a mob boss.
On September 24th, after long resisting moving toward impeachment, Pelosi made it official.
I'm announcing the House of Representatives moving forward with an official impeachment inquiry. The President must be held accountable. No one is above the law.
There was now no turning back. Trump had allegedly extorted a foreign leader for his personal political gain, so the House was moving to impeach him, and Republicans were going to have to take a vote. Do they condone what the president did, or do they condemn it? And the next day, Trump did the unthinkable. He confessed.
The conversation I had was largely congratulatory, was largely corruption, all of the corruption taking place, was largely the fact that we don't want our people, like Vice President Biden and his son, creating to the corruption already in the Ukraine.
Episode 4, Impeaching. In early September, a standoff started brewing between the White House and Congress. On September 9th, the intelligence community's inspector general, a man named Michael Atkinson, alerted the House Intelligence Committee to the existence of a whistleblower complaint. And this whistleblower complaint was apparently of an urgent concern about the president's behavior.
You issued a subpoena on Friday for the acting director of intelligence, alleging he's withholding a whistleblower disclosure, possibly to protect President Trump. That's a pretty significant allegation here. We're putting up a quote on the screen from you. Have you gotten a response to this letter?
We've gotten a response, and the director has said essentially that he is answering to a higher authority and refusing to turn over the whistleblower complaint. This is deeply troubling.
Normally, the Intelligence Committee, whose job it is to oversee the U.S. intelligence agencies, would be able to review that whistleblower complaint themselves within 10 days of it being filed. That is why you have a legislative branch to do oversight of the executive branch. But this time, there was a holdup. The acting director of national intelligence, a man named Joseph McGuire, had withheld the complaint from Congress for a full month. The whistleblower had filed the complaint all the way back on August 12th. This was a big deal. Trump's first director of national intelligence had been former Indiana Congressman Dan Coats. He was one of the few administration officials who stood up to Trump, repeatedly confirming that Russia had hacked our elections in 2016, even as Trump denied it. But after months of reports that Trump wanted him out, Coats had officially resigned on August 15th, just 3 days after the whistleblower lodged their complaint. Not only that, his second in command, a career intelligence official, had stepped down with him. It looked like Trump was clearing the way to install a loyalist in charge of the U.S. intelligence community, just as he'd done with the Department of Justice the year earlier by forcing out Jeff Sessions and replacing him with Bill Barr. His first choice was a man named John Ratcliffe, a Republican on the House Intel Committee, who'd made a name for himself attacking the Russia investigation, including at Mueller's hearing on July 24th.
Can you give me an example other than Donald Trump where the Justice Department determined that an investigated person was not exonerated because their innocence was not conclusively determined?
But in August, just after this whistleblower had lodged his complaint, Trump nominated Ratcliffe. But his nomination went down in flames, as it was revealed he had apparently lied about prosecuting terrorists when he was a U.S. attorney. But now it was starting to look like Trump didn't even need to name a successor, and that was because McGuire was frozen. He was stuck between being a good soldier and to his oath to the Constitution, his duty to the country. But in the meantime, Adam Schiff was having none of it. The whistleblower had actually notified his committee of his complaint, so they knew it existed, and Schiff wanted to see it. In the very first episode of the Asset Podcast, which we put out all the way back in April of 2019, we talked about the whirlwind of news in the first few weeks of 2017 when the Russia scandal broke. Now, more than 2 years later, with the Russia scandal losing steam, with reporters being moved on to other beats, along came another whirlwind. September 18th.
This morning, we're learning a phone call between President Trump and another world leader prompted a whistleblower complaint at the center of a growing scandal in Washington. The Washington Post first reporting that an intelligence official was so bothered by a promise President Trump made to a foreign leader that he filed a formal complaint with the inspector general.
September 19th.
She and her colleagues report, quote, a whistleblower complaint about President Trump made by an intelligence official centers on Ukraine.
September 20th.
We know now that the president in a July phone call repeatedly pressured the president of Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden's son, according to people familiar with the matter.
September 22nd.
President Trump added new detail about his July phone call with Ukraine's president.
The conversation I had was largely congratulatory.
Including for the first time how Joe Biden and his son Hunter played into that conversation.
And September 23rd.
I want to just go to the Washington Post reporting that President Trump told his acting chief of staff, as I mentioned, Mick Mulvaney, to hold back almost $400 million in military aid for Ukraine at least a week before a phone call in which Trump is said to have pressured the Ukrainian president to investigate the son of a political opponent.
The White House was still trying to stonewall. But this time, Congress wasn't going to take it lying down. And on September 24th, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, called the press conference.
The actions of the Trump presidency revealed the dishonorable fact of the president's betrayal of his oath of office, betrayal of our national security, and betrayal of the integrity of our elections. Therefore, today, I'm announcing the House of Representatives moving forward with an official impeachment inquiry.
And that's when the dam really started to break. On the morning of September 25th, 2 months to the day after his now famous call with Ukrainian President Zelensky, Trump announced he would be releasing the transcript of the call. Now, why he actually did this remains a big question. There are reports that they thought in the White House it was going to be exonerating. But there were also rumors that people were threatening to resign if Trump didn't release the transcript of the call. When news came that the call transcript was coming, that it was going to be released, at first we didn't know what to expect. Even after all the reporting, maybe it was a misdirection, maybe it was heavily edited, maybe it was the dreaded nothing burger. No one knew that the White House would release a transcript that would ultimately fuel President Trump's impeachment. And then Trump released the transcript of the call.
What stood out to me about the transcript is that the president talks about two things explicitly. One is CrowdStrike. He seems to think that the origins of the Mueller probe began in Ukraine, and he wants the president's help getting to the bottom of that. And then he does talk about Vice President Biden and how he used his connections in Ukraine to drop a prosecution into his son. And repeatedly, Hallie, the president talks about the need for Rudy Giuliani and the Attorney General William Barr to get in touch with the
president of Ukraine and his prosecutors there to try to get to the bottom of this, to open investigations into CrowdStrike and into the Bidens.
We broke it down in detail last episode, so if you haven't listened to that, you can go back and hear our full analysis. But the basic fact is that even with those mysterious dot, dot, dots, the ones that suggest the White House edited out the really damning stuff, it amounted to a confession. It was a mob shakedown. It sounded like it was from The Godfather. And then the confessions kept coming in. And that very day, on September 25th, Trump was in New York at the UN, where he met with Zelensky. And it was awkward.
It was beautiful. It was just a perfect conversation.
And the next morning, the White House released the full whistleblower complaint. And the complaint revealed that the administration took desperate measures to cover up the phone call that he had with Zelensky, hiding the records on a super top secret server that very, very few people, even in the White House, could access. This server was being used as a cover-up tool. It wasn't to protect U.S. national secrets. It wasn't to protect U.S. national security. It was to protect Trump politically. Apparently, there were other calls on that server, too, including ones with the Chinese President Xi Jinping and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The next day, on September 26th, there was a hearing with the acting DNI McGuire. There, he confirmed that the Department of Justice was in on hiding the whistleblower complaint, that they didn't want him to make it public.
My office consulted with the United States Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel and included the Inspector General in those consultations.
In other words, Bill Barr, who Trump mentioned on the call with Zelensky, who is named in the whistleblower complaint, who Trump specifically appointed to protect him from investigations, his fingerprints were all over the decision to keep the whistleblower complaint secret from Congress to protect the president. That wasn't all. Rudy Giuliani had confirmed more than a week before that he pressured Ukraine to investigate the Bidens, and now he was looping the State Department in on it too.
The whistleblower falsely alleges that I was operating on my own. Well, I wasn't operating on my own. I went to meet Mr. Zelensky's aide at the request of the State Department.
Mick Mulvaney, who's called the acting chief of staff when he should just be called the chief of staff because there's really no such thing as acting because the president just gets to appoint his chief of staff, and who's also the head of the Office of Management and Budget, it turned out that his Office of Management and Budget, OMB, was actually behind freezing the military aid to Ukraine. And Mulvaney decided to hold a White House press conference where he confirmed it explicitly.
Did he also mention to me in the past that the corruption related to the DNC server? Absolutely. No question about that. But that's it. And that's why we held up the money. Now, there was a report.
So the demand for an investigation into the Democrats was part of the reason that to withhold funding to Ukraine.
The look back to what happened in 2016 certainly was part of the thing that he was worried about in corruption with that nation. And that is absolutely appropriate.
Withholding the funding.
Yeah.
But to be clear, what you just described is a quid pro quo. It is funding will not flow unless the investigation into the Democratic server happened as well.
We do that all the time.
Mulvaney had just come out and confirmed the crime. People were stunned. Reporters were in shock. And if that wasn't enough, the call, the whistleblower complaint, Giuliani admitting to it, Mulvaney admitting to it, Trump then said it himself on the White House lawn in front of dozens of reporters and their cameras.
Well, I would think that if they were honest about it, they'd start a major investigation into the Bidens. It's a very simple answer. They should investigate the Bidens.
Pretty soon, it became clear that this wasn't an unforced error. It was a strategy. In fact, it resembled the same strategy they had used in the Russia investigation. Deny it, admit it, claim it was actually good, accuse the other side of doing the same thing, and then move on before the news cycle can catch up. But this time, things were different. This time, Democrats weren't going to let this go quietly into the night. Weren't going to let it play out in court or hold a hearing or just demand more investigations. No, they were going to impeach him over it. And that changed everything. I'm Max Bergman, and this is The Asset. Unpacking the reasons why Democrats moved forward with impeachment in September 2019, when they stood pat just a few months earlier in April when the Russia investigation came out, reveals a lot about the power that political leaders have to set the narrative and to drive the agenda. The narrative that has now taken hold as of December 2019 amongst much of the general public when it relates to Trump and Russia, that Mueller was a dud. He didn't have it, and nothing came of the Russia investigation. That's become the general conventional wisdom about the Mueller investigation. There's a lot to criticize Mueller for. The passive voice, the double negatives when the Mueller report said, we can't not say that he didn't obstruct justice. I mean, come on, just say he obstructed justice. And the Mueller report didn't make clear the whole point of Volume 1, which was to identify in 198 pages the 200-plus contacts that Trump had with Russia during the campaign, that the fact that they were incriminating, the fact that they wanted to cover those up. And that's what they did when they sought to obstruct justice, which was Volume 2. All of that was in the report. It was, as we noted, an impeachment referral. It was an incredibly damning document that really should have gotten the president impeached. Any other president in history would have been immediately impeached for that. The Mueller report should have ignited a furor. It should have set everything on fire. Yes, some people did come out for impeachment.
Congress has a duty to keep the president in check. We have a job to do. And I think we owe it to the American people to represent them. And that's why I took the position I did. And I would do it whether it was a Democratic president or a Republican president. It doesn't matter to me.
This is not a fight I wanted to take on, but this is the fight in front of us now. This is not about politics. This is about the Constitution of the United States of America. We took an oath not to try to protect Donald Trump. We took an oath to protect and serve the Constitution of the United States of America. And the way we do that is we begin impeachment proceedings now against this president.
But Democratic leadership held pat. Their response to this totally insane report was almost nothing. It was, we need more, we need to investigate more. And this came at the time the country was looking for a signal. It was looking for a sign. They were looking to see how Democrats would react to the report. They weren't going to read it. They have wives. They have jobs. It was super long. So the response from Democrats, with notable exceptions, was probably the worst thing possible. The fact that you're saying that you need more, that you need to investigate more, that this isn't enough, makes it seem exonerating, especially when the president had a very clear and simple message. No collusion, no obstruction, total exoneration.
Do you think the House should impeach the president of the United States?
I don't think we're there yet, but we have a consensus on a few things. One of the things that Natasha was talking about, there are going to be aggressive committee investigations.
And to understand why Democrats took this approach, why in April their position was to stand pat, why Democratic leadership didn't move, why Nancy Pelosi didn't go to the podium in April and say, oh my God, we're going to impeach this guy because this is unbelievable conduct, as she did in September, we have to talk a little politics. On March 11, 2019, Nancy Pelosi gave an interview to The Washington Post. The headline said it all. Quote, Nancy Pelosi on impeaching Trump, he's just not worth it.
Speaker Pelosi says President Trump is just not worth it. Now, she is not closing the door completely on impeachment, but she says that unless there is something so compelling and overwhelming and bipartisan that it's not worth it because impeachment would greatly divide the country.
And to partly understand why Pelosi had this view on impeachment, you kind of need to go back and remember 1998. In 1998, when Bill Clinton was being impeached by the House of Representatives, it was an overtly political affair. The House Judiciary Committee voted to move forward on impeachment just a month before the 98 election. And then it seemed to backfire. The House Republicans didn't make any gains. In fact, they lost 5 seats in the House, which isn't a lot, especially when you consider the President of the United States, Bill Clinton, had an approval rating above 60%. But then Republicans went forward, they had a vote on the floor of the House, and it was dramatic. Newt Gingrich had decided to resign. The incoming Speaker of the House, a man named Bob Livingston, took to the floor. During that crazy year of 1998, Larry Flynt, the owner of Hustler magazine, actually promised to pay women that had affairs with Republicans that were leading the charge on impeachment. He wanted to expose their hypocrisy. And someone came forward and said they had had an affair with Bob Livingston. As Bob Livingston took to the floor, he called on Clinton to be impeached. And Democrats stood up and said, "You resign, you resign." And then he did.
"You, sir, may resign your post."
House will be in order.
And
the House will be in order.
And I can only challenge you in such fashion if I am willing to heed my own words. To my colleagues, my friends, and most especially my wife and family, I have hurt you all deeply, and I beg your forgiveness. I was prepared to lead our narrow majority as Speaker, so I must set the example that I hope President Clinton will follow. I will not stand for Speaker of the House on January 6th.
This was a really jarring moment for those engaged in the political process. The Republicans came to take down a president, and it ended up backfiring. It ended up resulting in two Republican Speakers of the House resigning. So for Nancy Pelosi, impeachment was politically dangerous. Never mind that in 2000, George W. Bush effectively ran on the impeachment scandal to say that he was going to restore honor and integrity to the White House. But for Pelosi, impeachment was a political minefield, and so she was heavily resistant to going down that path. And so when the Mueller report came out, the Democrats' line was, "Trump's just not worth it. It's not worth the potential blowback." Whatever the Mueller report said about Trump, it just wasn't worth the risk to hold him accountable. It could backfire. This became the political conventional wisdom. Impeaching the president was going to be bad for Democrats, not for Republicans. And because of that, because Democrats looked like they were trying to avoid the fight, Trump soon realized that they could just obstruct Congress, deny documents and witnesses, and let this drag out in the courts. This was frankly a shocking move that no one had expected could happen. The whole idea when Democrats took back Congress was that they could hold hearings. They could call people. People would have to show up because people have to show up when Congress calls them. Whether you're a rich banker or whether you're Mark Zuckerberg, when you're subpoenaed by Congress, you have to show up. In the Trump administration, the White House not showing up, not providing documents, was frankly in a shocking level of obstruction. And so it went to the courts. By going through the courts, Trump knew it could take months, if not years, and this would deny Democrats the spectacle, deny them the witnesses, the hearings that they needed to inform the public of Trump's wrongdoing. They knew public interest would fade. But while there were things Democrats could do, there were lots of witnesses that could tell us a lot about what happened during the election that couldn't cite executive privilege. Democrats largely refused to call them. They decided they were going to let this play out on the courts as well. And that was a total loser. And you know how we know that was a total loser? Because Democrats stopped pursuing that strategy once they decided to get going on impeachment over Ukraine. They stopped saying, "We're going to allow this to play out in the courts." No, now they were just going to go forward. And if the courts could comply in time, fine. They could have done that on Russia, but they didn't. But as Democrats were stumbling toward impeachment, there was growing anger amongst the progressive base and many in the Democratic caucus over how they could not act over Trump's criminality revealed in the Mueller report.
You just heard Speaker Nancy Pelosi say flat out that Donald Trump does not know right from wrong, that she believes that he's been involved in a criminal cover-up. And yet, the Speaker steadfastly, doggedly, absolutely, despite a growing rebellion in her own caucus, refuses to use the power that the Constitution gives the House of Representatives, and only the House of Representatives, to check a president who is engaged in crimes. The Speaker will not allow this president to be impeached, as of now at least. She is going to spare him that.
There was constant coverage of the infighting between Democrats. In August 8th, under immense pressure and wanting to move forward, House Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler announced that the Judiciary Committee would be conducting an impeachment inquiry. This was sort of like moving to an impeachment process through the back door. And it was unclear whether this actually had the backing of House leadership. But to Nadler, they were moving forward, which then could help them get the witnesses and the documents they were after. By failing to hold Trump accountable, something happened that was totally inevitable. The dude did it again. And we found out about it, not in September with the whistleblower, but in May. Remember in the previous episode, we talked about those New York Times stories, one on May 1st, another on May 9th, that literally outlined everything that Rudy Giuliani was up to, that Rudy was trying to get the Ukrainians to investigate Hunter Biden? Now, that caused a big stir. It caused outrage, but ultimately, everybody moved on and forgot about those stories. Why? Because Democrats weren't going to do anything about it. And when you're not going to do anything about it, people move on to the next scandal. So Trump continued to do exactly what the Mueller report outlined. He abused his office and sought to work with foreign powers to win an election. Because when someone commits a crime, gets caught, but doesn't face any punishment, the likelihood of them doing it again is pretty high. So as Democrats dragged their feet, a new scandal began to break, and this one was impossible to ignore.
But of course, this leads to the phone call on July 25th, which, by the way, happened the day after Mueller's testimony to Congress. We think it's worthy of this. But all of those actions leads us to, I would like you to do us a favor, though.
And Politico reported that throughout the month of August, progressive groups pressured moderate Democrats at their town halls, at their offices. The numbers in the House for impeachment were growing. By September, over half the Democratic caucus was for impeaching Trump over the Russia investigation. Progressives were seething at House leadership for not having moved forward after the Mueller investigation. And so when the Ukraine scandal finally broke out into the open, here we had Trump being caught red-handed, trying to do it again. The reaction from many progressives was, oh my God, you have to move forward. How could you not hold this guy accountable? On September 23rd, Michelle Goldberg of the New York Times wrote an op-ed titled, Nancy Pelosi's Failure to Launch. She wrote, Pelosi's, quote, hesitation on impeachment empowers a lawless president. Pelosi's calculated timidity on impeachment is emboldening Trump, demoralizing progressives, and failing the country.
But it's interesting because when I've talked to people in the past about why she's been so reticent on impeachment, often they've said, you know, the public isn't there. And I think for pro-impeachment people, that's been very frustrating because it's the job of Democratic leaders to lead public opinion rather than follow it.
And that very day, seven vulnerable Democrats from red districts opened the floodgates. In an op-ed on September 23rd, they came out and called for the beginning of an impeachment inquiry. And so the following day, on September 24th, Nancy Pelosi took to the podium and announced a formal impeachment inquiry. She didn't want to do this. This was not something that Democratic leadership had wanted to do. But his criminality was so obvious that they simply had to move forward. And as soon as they moved forward, one thread after another started to come free. People started to come forward. They started to use their subpoena power, and everything started to unravel for the president. More information started to come out. Witnesses started to come forward. Because now there was an actual process for accountability. But the new question was, how do you impeach him? How do you impeach Trump? I mean, there are literally so many damn things you could impeach this guy for. The Mueller report, kids in cages, Charlottesville, all the rape allegations. I mean, this guy is a walking crime spree. There were just so many crimes and scandals. Do you include everything or do you narrow it to just one scandal? Democrats looked to the Russia investigation for lessons. First, they realized they needed a clear message. Democrats had spent more than 2 years on Russia without ever developing a clear, coherent message. They never said he did it. They never said he colluded. Instead, they spent 2 years telling voters again and again and again they needed to support the investigation and see where it leads, and that they wouldn't make up their minds until the investigation was over. And it turned out when the investigation ended, they still didn't make up their minds. But they stuck to that message at all costs. Now Democrats were going to have a clear message. They stuck to the message of protect the investigation at all costs. And so when damaging story after damaging story came out, whether it was about George Papadopoulos colluding with the Russians, or about Jared Kushner having these sketchy meetings, or about Donald Trump Jr. getting an email, meeting with the Russians in the midst of the elections about getting dirt on Hillary Clinton, Democrats never said he did it. They never said he colluded. But the view now of the Russia investigation was that it became so complicated. It was so confusing. No one can understand it. It wasn't that there wasn't a clear message. It's just impossible to understand. That actually isn't true. The Russia investigation, the Russia scandal, is very simple to understand. Russia offered to help Trump win, and Trump said he'd love it, and then they worked together. It was pretty damn simple, but if you have no message, if you never explain what's happening, it all seems incredibly confusing. But whatever mental block that had prevented Democrats from just saying he did it, he colluded, they were out there loud and strong with the messaging on Ukraine. This was an affront to democracy. It was a quid pro quo. It was extortion, bribery. It was illegal, and it was impeachable. Ukraine investigation is also easy to break down. We were able to fit most of it into one episode. The story is Trump extorted Ukraine to get them to interfere in 2020 by attacking his opponent. And Democrats, to their credit, have been hammering that message hard from the get-go. Here's Adam Schiff breaking it down literally on day one of the impeachment inquiry on September 25th, the day the White House released the transcript of Trump's call with Zelensky.
The notes of the call reflect a conversation far more damning than I or many others had imagined. Because what those notes reflect is a classic mafia-like shakedown of a foreign leader.
The other lesson that Democrats took from the Mueller investigation was go narrow. Don't let it sprawl. The Russia investigation became too complicated. It was too confusing. It was too sprawling. The problem is that Ukraine in some ways is such a slam dunk case that by making it the sole focus of impeachment, impeachment has become extremely narrow, possibly too narrow. The House Intelligence Committee called only 2 weeks worth of witnesses. And while that's partly because that's all they really needed to make this case, it's also because they're basically trying Trump on one narrow topic. One of the problems, however, is what that means is that they haven't really put this in a broader context. As they've moved to hearings, they've sort of lost the plot on how this fits into the underlying problems of Trump's presidency. In fact, what made the Russia investigation all-consuming was how deep the collusion went, was how deep the corruption went. The sprawling nature of the Russia investigation wasn't to its detriment. It was actually to its benefit. It stayed interesting. It stayed in the news. It was constantly covered. The actual lesson to be learned of the Russia investigation is to have a message, but to not be afraid to let the investigation sprawl, to follow it, to chase it down, but to always make clear what you're investigating. Even during the Ukraine scandal, other corrupt threads have emerged. Bill Barr's DOJ was actively withholding the whistleblower complaint from Congress, obstructing the investigation into what exactly Trump had asked of Zelensky. And Trump had even mobilized his biggest defenders to protect him from the Russia impeachment proceedings and to push one of his all-time favorite conspiracy theories that the entire Russia investigation was one big hoax, it was one big setup. To this end, Attorney General Bill Barr actually began flying around the world, traveling to Italy and the UK, and trying to meet with these governments to dig up dirt on the U.S. intelligence community to support Trump's conspiracy theory. And spoiler alert, he couldn't really find any evidence. But yet, this is just another example of Trump using his office to pressure a foreign country for his own personal gain. Trump even pressured the Australian Prime Minister to help Barr in his efforts. Trump even reportedly pressured UK Prime Minister Theresa May as well. The Department of Justice and the Office of the Attorney General was operating as if it was part of Trump's re-election campaign. This should be impeachable. While the whistle was blown on the Ukraine schemes, it's not like this was a one-off. He tried to do the exact same thing with China.
There is also new CNN reporting on President Trump's public call out in the open for China to get involved.
China should start an investigation into the Bidens, because what happened in China is just about as bad as what happened with Ukraine.
Okay, CNN has learned this is not the first time that President Trump raised Biden's name with China.
We already knew that President Trump mixed domestic politics in U.S. interactions with Ukraine. We now know that the president mixed politics as well in U.S. interactions with China, of course, in the midst of consequential trade negotiations, bringing up both Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren in a phone call with the Chinese president in June of this year. In addition to that, we know that the records, the transcript of this phone call with President Xi in June, was, like others with the Ukrainian leader, moved to this highly classified code word protected system.
And another Trump China advisor said this on CNN.
Have you ever raised investigating Joe Biden or his son during your contacts with Chinese officials?
Me, personally? Yeah. Now, here's the thing. I will never talk about what happens inside the White House, okay? Not confirm or deny, because that's the slippery slope.
This caused a freakout amongst Republicans. Susan Collins reacted with alarm.
Republican Senator Susan Collins tells the Bangor Daily News that President Trump's invitation for China to investigate the Bidens was, quote, completely inappropriate. This makes Collins one of the few Republicans to speak out against the president.
Trump's corruption isn't always political either. Sometimes it's just for outright personal gain, like when he suggested hosting the next G7 meeting at his Doral Golf Club, which was such a clearly corrupt idea even for Trump that he quickly backtracked. And then Trump abruptly okayed the Turkish invasion of Syria, removed U.S. forces in the process, betraying the Kurds who had literally been fighting ISIS with us, and opening the door for the Russians to move in. Russian forces now occupy U.S. bases in Syria. As this happened, cracks started to emerge in the Republican Party. Joni Ernst was asked at a town hall in October.
Where is the line? When are you guys going to say enough and stand up and say, you know what, I'm not backing any of this? Because we constantly have everybody, oh, well, it's not this, it's not that, or, you know, everything else. But yet you still stand there silent, and your silence is supporting him and not standing up.
Republicans were running from reporters in the hallways of their congressional office buildings. Those that went on TV to defend Trump came off looking terrible. Then, out of nowhere, Congressman Francis Rooney from a safe Republican district in Florida went on CNN.
Mick Mulvaney laid out a quid pro quo. What is your response?
Well, yeah, whatever might have been gray and unclear before is certainly quite clear right now that the actions were related to getting some of the Ukraine to do some of these things. I think that, as you just put on there, Senator Murkowski and Mitt said it perfectly. We're not supposed to use government power and prestige for political gain. It's certainly very, very serious and troubling. But I'm very mindful of the fact that back during Watergate, everybody said, oh, it's a witch hunt to get Nixon. Turns out it wasn't a witch hunt. It was absolutely correct. So I just want to make sure that I get all the data I can get. And I'm talking to everybody I can talk to understand all this.
Tim Alberta reported in Politico, quote, venting privately about the president has become a hallowed pastime in Republican-controlled Washington, a sort of ritualistic release for those lawmakers tasked with routinely defending the indefensible. And Rooney had long indulged without consequence. But after Rooney went public, Alberta reports, quote, all of a sudden, the once invisible congressman was the subject of constant surveillance. Rooney could go nowhere, say nothing without the eyes of the party on him. House Republican leaders, having been made aware of Rooney's agitating, deputized lawmakers to monitor the malcontent. The White House, both its political team and its legislative affairs shop, did likewise. Before long, the president himself was briefed on the threat from Rooney. Disturbed, Trump began calling his friends and associates on Capitol Hill and in Florida, trying to make sense of the situation. Ultimately, Alberta writes, Republican leaders in Washington and Florida settled on a simple course of action, orchestrating a whisper campaign aimed at sowing doubts about his devotion to the president. The focal point would be on Rooney's bloody red district. That way, if and when Rooney broke ranks, the uprising back home would appear instant and organic. The recoil wouldn't just scare Rooney straight, it would provide a cautionary tale for any Republican tempted to follow his lead. This is an administration keeping Congress in line by fear. The White House had a reign of terror campaign in the House to prevent Republicans from breaking, to prevent the dam from breaking. And while that has appeared effective, it also shows how worried they are. They're not taking anything for granted here. But as the scandal was spiraling out of control, as China, Turkey, other forms of corruption were emerging, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman were being arrested, the hearings began and those other threads fell off. And this was about Ukraine. It was about this one particular scandal. And this meant the scandal was going to be confined, and this lack of sprawl meant that the Republicans could judge the strength of the hurricane coming at them. And that hurricane was strong, but they could take the measure of the storm, and instead of fleeing for cover, the Republicans could close the shutters, batten down the hatches, and go to an interior room and shelter in place. And that's exactly what they were about to do.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
With the impeachment hearings coming, Republicans needed a counterargument, but nothing was landing. So when you have nothing in Washington, you start talking about process.
So why am I not going to watch this hearing tomorrow? Because I think it is a threat to the presidency. I don't want to legitimize it. It's un-American. It denies the basics of due process.
And so we heard endless whining from Republicans in the House about process, about secret hearings in the dungeon of the Capitol.
Hi, Andy Biggs here from Arizona's 5th Congressional District. This morning, many of my colleagues, more than three dozen of my colleagues, moved to the underground basement hidden chamber that Adam Schiff has been holding this impeachment testimony against the president.
In fact, these were actually in the brand new Hipsey offices where Republicans and Democrats work. Republicans then complained that they weren't allowed in, and then they stormed past security into the secret deposition rooms.
We're going to go and see if we can get inside. Let's see if we can get in.
Congressman, please, have any questions?
But it turned out many of them were on the committees, had the ability to attend these hearings. And it also turned out when they stormed into the SCIF, the secret meeting room, where you're not supposed to have any electronics, many of them brought their phones and started tweeting from the room, which is a huge security violation. They complained there was no formal impeachment vote. Then they held the vote. The secret depositions that took place, and they were secret because they didn't want people coordinating their stories, were then made available to the public. And then all the complaints about these hearings being held in secret were then held publicly. But from Republicans, we heard process, process, process. And as Mitch McConnell famously stated,
you complain about process when you're losing.
But when the House Intelligence Committee began public hearings to hear fact witnesses in the impeachment inquiry of Donald Trump, a question emerged: what would be the counterargument? What would Republicans actually say during these hearings? And so the Republicans sought to develop a counter-narrative that isn't actually coherent, that doesn't actually make sense, but it makes sense for Fox News when you piece it all together, which is all Trump and the Republicans really thought they needed. They just needed to maintain Republican support, after all. They didn't need to convince the country. So Fox News and One American News Network and Breitbart and the rest of the right-wing ecosystem have created an entirely different world surrounding the impeachment hearings. They claim that Trump actually cared about corruption, and that's why he was pressuring Zelensky.
Mr. Sondland, in his opening statement, said that there was quid pro quo. There was quid pro quo, he said, because you wanted an investigation into corruption in exchange for a visit to the White House or something like that.
Yeah, well, that's total nonsense. I do want always corruption. I say that to anybody. Why should we give money to a country that's known corrupt? It's a very corrupt country.
They said that this was a witch hunt by Democrats obsessed with getting Trump.
Adam Schiff, meanwhile, the congressman from Burbank, was ecstatic. Schiff has spent years obsessing over impeachment like it was a young Jodie Foster.
They said everything is hearsay.
Again, this blew up right in Schiff's face and the Democrats' faces.
There was no quid pro quo.
I think you saw Mick Mulvaney clarify a statement. He said, let me be clear, there was absolutely no quid pro quo between Ukraine military aid and any investigation into the 2016 election.
The real collusion was Ukraine.
Senator Kennedy, who do you believe was responsible for hacking the DNC and Clinton campaign computers, their emails? Was it Russia or Ukraine?
I don't know, nor do you, nor do any of us. Miss Hill.
Well, I mean, let me just interrupt to say the entire intelligence community says it was Russia.
Right, but it could also be Ukraine.
The real problem is the whistleblower.
So it's going to be the president of the United States in a conversation that was intercepted by a rotten snitch. I'd love to whap him, but that's another story. Imagine this poor president, his whole tenure in office has been marked by snitches and rats and backstabbers.
Yep.
It's amazing how he functions at all.
The witnesses are disloyal.
Here we have a U.S. national security official who is advising Ukraine while working inside the White House apparently against the president's interest, and usually they spoke in English.
The real corruption is the Bidens.
It is a crime to use your public office to confer a benefit in exchange for something of personal value to yourself or your family.
This is just an effort to overturn the 2016 election.
Oh, I think Republicans recognize that this is just another attempt by Democrats to overturn the election of 2016.
According to the Washington Post, Trump's defenders have given at least 24 different defenses, all of them false, most of them totally ridiculous. Republicans also started to try to build a case that it was Ukraine that conspired to help the Democrats. You heard a lot about Alexandra Chalupa. You heard about a Ken Vogel Politico story from January 2017. You heard about the Ukrainian who helped reveal Manafort's corruption and his infamous black ledger. They were trying to build the case that it was Ukraine that interfered in 2016, not Russia. This is the message that Donald Trump was pushing with Zelensky when he said that they had a server when CrowdStrike was responsible and somehow linked to Ukraine. And it turns out that it is a Russian conspiracy theory. More specifically, a conspiracy theory from Russian intelligence. This is Russian active measures in action. In November, we also learned about the origins of this conspiracy theory. BuzzFeed had filed FOIA requests, Freedom of Information requests, for the FBI interviews, the 302s, that were done with witnesses from the Mueller investigation. And according to what Trump's deputy campaign manager, Rick Gates, told investigators, the notion that Ukraine interfered in 2016 came during the election from a guy named Konstantin Kalimnik, the guy who was believed by the U.S. government to be a Russian intelligence officer, to be GRU. Manafort, according to Gates, quote, parroted Kalimnik, who pushed it ever since, that it was Ukraine, not Russia. Pre-Trump, this would be considered one of the most successful Russian active measures campaigns in history. Right up there with spreading the lie that the U.S. government created AIDS, as we talked about in episode 6 of season 1. But now it's par for the course. Republicans in Congress are pushing a Russian conspiracy theory to defend the President of the United States and conveniently to defend Vladimir Putin, to let Russia off the hook for what it did in 2016. That's exactly what Putin wants. Part of what also makes this so absurd is that the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes, looks like he's actually been a key player in Trump's Ukraine extortion scheme. Nunes has been one of Trump's most fervent backers, willing to do almost anything, even if it looks incredibly pathetic. Remember that unmasking scandal, Uranium One, the Nunes memo? And remember that whole Uber story? This is a guy literally willing to do anything for the president, apparently. But this time, it went even deeper. While the public hearings were happening, reporters were learning some pretty incredibly damning things about what Nunes had been up to the previous summer. See, Nunes hadn't just been pushing his nonsense at home. Just like Trump, Barr, and Giuliani, he may also have been digging for dirt abroad, while he was actually chairing the House Intelligence Committee, one of the most powerful committees in the entire U.S. Congress. A lot of this information comes from Lev Parnas, one of the indicted Florida businessmen we talked a lot about in episode 2. Since Trump tried to throw him under the bus, it looks like Parnas wants to come clean and tell people what he knows, including about Devin Nunes. According to Parnas, he was actually working with Nunes before he started working with Rudy Giuliani. In late 2018, Nunes took a trip to Europe to try to dig up or make up dirt to discredit the Russia investigation. That trip was part of the public record. What we didn't know is that Parnas was also involved. He was doing exactly the same thing he was doing for Giuliani, setting up meetings with shady European officials promising dirt on Trump's opponents. And you'll notice this lines up perfectly with the time where Parnas and his buddy Igor Fruman were pushing to get the U.S. ambassador in Ukraine forced out for blocking their corrupt deals. And that wasn't even the only trip. According to Parnas, Nunes and his aides got his help setting up a trip in March to go to Ukraine and meet with, who else? The corrupt former prosecutor general, Viktor Shokin. He's the one behind the conspiracy theories about the Bidens. That trip was all set to go when Nunes realized he would have to clear the trip with Schiff, the chairman of the committee. And that's how you know this wasn't above board. Nunes, the guy behind unmasking in the Nunes memo, called off the whole trip because he didn't want it to go public. And when it came out, when Eric Swalwell brought it up in public hearings, you could practically see Nunes trying to disappear into his chair.
Mr. Chairman, I ask unanimous consent to put into the record the Daily Beast story. Lev Parnas helped Rep. Devin Nunes' investigations from yesterday. First two paragraphs reading, Lev Parnas, an indicted associate of Rudy Giuliani, helped arrange meetings and calls in Europe for Rep. Devin Nunes in 2018, Parnas' lawyer Ed McMahon told the Daily Beast. Nunes' aide Derek Harvey participated in the meetings, the lawyer said, which were arranged to help Nunes' investigative work. Now, if this story is correct, the ranking member may have actually been projecting. And in fact, he may be the fact witness if he is working with indicted individuals around our investigation.
Let me just note that Devin Nunes denies that he did anything wrong, that there was anything untoward that happened, and he is suing CNN for a whole lot of money, claiming their story is inaccurate. We are saying this because we don't want to get sued, but let's also note that Devin Nunes is suing a Twitter account named Devin's Cow. But, as always, there's more. One of Nunes's aides, a guy named Derek Harvey, who was part of the first trip and was going to be part of the second trip, according to CNN, that wasn't Harvey's only brush with Parnas. It turns out he was part of a group that called themselves the BLT team. It's basically a who's who of the Ukraine investigation. Parnas, Fruman, Giuliani, John Solomon, Joe DiGenova, Victoria Townsend, and Derek Harvey. They called themselves that because they liked to meet at the BLT restaurant in Trump's hotel in D.C. So Nunes and one of his top aides are, as Swalwell said, fact witnesses in the impeachment investigation. They were actually wrapped up in the effort to pressure Ukraine to make up dirt on his opponent. When you want to know why Devin Nunes looks so pale and uncomfortable? Well, because he should have been on trial as well. And it turns out the House Intelligence Committee got call records showing that Nunes spoke with Giuliani and Parnas over the phone numerous times in April and May of this year. And what happened in April and May of this year? That's right. That's when the Mueller report came out. And they were looking to protect the president. They were looking to dig up dirt. They were looking to provide a counter narrative. As the public hearings went forward, they went terribly for the president. The case was basically open and shut. Democrats had proven the case masterfully. It was like a lawyer before a jury. There's no doubt that any unbiased jury would convict. But Congress isn't a courtroom, and this wasn't a court of law. As the hearings were going on, Fox did their things, the counter-narrative was reaching Trump supporters, and while poll numbers for impeachment and removal were trending above 50%, which was higher than right before Nixon resigned, Republican support hardened in favor of Trump and against impeachment. Trump's overall approval numbers didn't really move. And one of the most disheartening moments of the hearing came on the final day.
An impeachable offense should be compelling, overwhelmingly clear, and unambiguous, and it's not something to be rushed or taken lightly. I've not heard evidence proving the president committed bribery or extortion. I also reject the notion that holding this view means supporting all the foreign policy choices we have been hearing about over these last few weeks.
That was Republican Congressman Will Hurd. Hurd is a self-styled moderate, a former CIA officer, who's made a big show of his discomfort with Trump. He's also retiring, meaning he's the exact person you'd hope would be willing to see the light, that would do something brave to put country ahead of party, his oath before his loyalty to Trump. But he didn't. Somewhere down the line, he decided that he, too, would toe the party line, even if it meant ignoring the mountain of evidence before him and signing off on Trump's corruption. It was later reported that he was thinking about his political future and may run for office again in the future. And at least right now, for Republicans, if you're thinking about running again, you have to stand with the crook.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
Now, I have had no problem in being critical of Democrats throughout this podcast. Hell, I blasted them a lot in this episode. But here, in these 2 weeks of hearings, Democrats did a masterful job. They nailed the case. The witnesses were compelling. The information was clear. New information came to light. It was interesting. It had pizzazz. And most importantly of all, it was clearly damaging. Trump was caught red-handed, and they showed the country that. There was no real Republican counterargument. The case was so airtight. It went as good as it could go. But we are not dealing with a rational party where facts matter. It's a party governed by fear, not by conscience. I think House Democrats, in the end, made the right call in keeping impeachment narrow and proving the case and bringing forth an airtight case. But where I think they erred is that they should have allowed all the other committees outside of House Intel to get to work and start digging, to look into China, to Turkey, to Trump's corruption. Let House Intel be the tip of the spear. Let them do a report on Ukraine, vote that report out, create articles of impeachment based off of it, and vote impeachment based off Ukraine. But don't stop your oversight. When the feds indict someone, they don't stop investigating all the other criminality. Yet the oversight committees basically froze their efforts, much to the frustration of many members of those committees. House leadership wanted the focus on Ukraine. But the reason this needed to sprawl, the reason other committees needed to keep revealing new information, was to show Republicans that there was no bottom to the corruption, and that uncovering the corruption was going to be never-ending, and that by standing with Trump, by voting to exonerate him, they're tying themselves to a crook who is going to be exposed again and again to keep the pressure on. But honestly, this is all a bit of Monday morning quarterbacking. If Democrats immediately started doing that, would the Republicans end up breaking? Would the red wall come down? I think you would have to say probably not. You would still bet against it. And to their credit, Democrats have told the courts and the American public they're interested in looking at Trump's obstruction related to the Mueller investigation and whether he lied to Mueller. They're continuing to fight in court to get Trump's tax returns and testimony from key witnesses from the Russia investigation. And they've suggested they may include charges on obstruction stemming from the Mueller investigation as well. I genuinely think Democrats have gotten this right. They've run this process with clarity and focus. The problem is that in our two-party system, one party has been captured by a demagogue. On October 15th, Nancy Pelosi went to the White House. An iconic image would soon come out of this meeting. She stood up across from the president and told him,
"All roads seem to lead to Putin with the president, though, isn't it so?"
She's right. All roads do lead to Putin. Trump colluded with Russia, not just his campaign, but Trump did personally. And his actions over the past 2 years, and especially over the past few months, show that he'll do whatever is in his personal interests. And what's in his personal interests is usually in Russia's interests as well. And we got a clear reminder of that in the midst of the Ukraine scandal. On Friday, November 15th, Congress was taking a break from Ambassador Yovanovitch's testimony when new news broke.
This is CNN Breaking News.
Roger Stone has been found guilty after a week and a half trial, a jury that's been deliberating now for close to 9 hours. They are now returning their verdict.
One of the biggest loose ends from the Russia investigation got tied up. Roger Stone, Trump's longtime political advisor, was found guilty on all charges. That meant that a jury decided beyond a reasonable doubt that he had lied about acting as a back channel between the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks, while WikiLeaks was working as a cutout for Russian intelligence. In other words, he lied about collusion. And it wasn't just collusion. What he lied about was Trump knowing. The trial revealed that Donald Trump was not only aware of, but actively directing his campaign's efforts to build a back channel to WikiLeaks, who they knew was a cutout for Russian intelligence. When the Trump campaign found out that Russia had hacked the DNC, that a hostile foreign government had attacked American democracy, Trump was happy about it, and he actively told his people to figure out how to profit off of this. On the one hand, we already knew that.
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing.
But the court verdict was further confirmation that what was going on behind closed doors was exactly what we thought based on what was happening out in the open. Trump colluded, and then he lied about it, not just to the public, but also to special counsel Robert Mueller. He lied to Mueller. That is a crime.
According to Gates's testimony, the Trump campaign was told months before WikiLeaks ever posted any stolen Democratic documents, months before they were told that WikiLeaks was going to start doing that during the campaign. Rick Gates also testified today that he witnessed a phone call between Trump and Roger Stone about a forthcoming document dump from WikiLeaks. And that sure makes it seem like the president may have lied in his written testimony to Robert Mueller when he told Mueller in writing that he never talked to Roger Stone about that subject.
And what this also revealed is the redactions, that parts of the Mueller report that were hidden from the public, the roughly 10% of the report that we haven't been able to see because it's been redacted, contains a lot of damning stuff. Parts of the redactions came to light in the trial of Roger Stone. But what should be abundantly clear is the depth of Donald Trump's corruption. What the Stone trial revealed is that Donald Trump was intimately involved in the Russian interference campaign. He knew about it and colluded with the Russians. He was part of this attack on our democracy. He aided and abetted it. He furthered it. What it shows is that all roads lead to Russia. And the Ukraine scandal is no exception. The Ukraine scandal is part of an effort to shield Trump from the political fallout of him colluding with Russia, of him being a Russian asset, of that being revealed by Mueller. That's why Rudy, the lawyer he hired for the Mueller investigation, spent a year digging up dirt that could help Trump create a counter-narrative. That's why we now know that Devin Nunes was trying to do the same thing, and why Trump was getting Parnas and Fruman to help them. And that's why Trump and his Republican accomplices were pushing Russian disinformation that Ukraine intervened. It is also not a coincidence that Trump was trying to extort Ukraine, the country fighting a war against Russia. In episode 3, we discussed how Trump sought out advice from Putin and Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. That all took place before the July 25th phone call, before the shakedown of Zelensky. And this wasn't the Moscow Project drawing the conclusions. This was people within the White House, former White House officials and current White House officials, saying that those meetings, those calls, helped turn Trump against Zelensky. And Putin is benefiting hugely from this entire Ukraine affair. The whole world now knows that Trump's commitment to Ukraine is paper thin, that he doesn't like Ukraine. And Ukraine is about to enter peace negotiations with Russia. So Russia knows that the leader of Ukraine's main ally, the United States, doesn't actually care to support them. This show is called The Asset for a reason. In last season, we outlined why Trump was an asset of Russia. And we asked the question whether he is witting or unwitting. We concluded that he was witting. He knew what was going on. Trump knew what Russia was doing. Trump knew about the crime and he ran toward it. And more than that, after the whole Russia affair, after the whole scandal came to light, it would have made all the political sense in the world for Trump to distance himself from Putin. But he's done the opposite. Everyone has said, that's really weird. Why does he keep doing this? He does it because he's a Russian asset. But when we concluded the last season, we added a twist. Trump isn't your typical witting asset. What we highlighted is that oftentimes people who betray the country, you bizarrely have some sympathy for, because they often do so because they have some terrible choice. They got caught cheating or gambling and would lose their family or their job. And so when faced with this terrible choice, they decide to betray their country. They don't do it because they want to. They do it because they feel they have to. Now, it's possible that Trump was faced with that terrible choice. I mean, there's a million ways to compromise Donald Trump. He is immensely compromisable. And maybe he was compromised and leveraged by some sex tape or illicit business dealing. But at the end of the day, the thing about Donald Trump is that he's just corrupt. To get him to be your asset, to do what you want him to do, you just have to buy him. So the full story does go back to Putin, but it also goes back to Trump. It's why we spent so much time in season one talking about his business history and how he got started. To understand why a corrupt person is acting the way they're acting, you need to know who owns them. And that's why his financial records, why the records from Deutsche Bank, why his tax records are so critical. they tell us who bought Trump, who owns him. And what's pretty clear is that it's Russian money. That's Vladimir Putin and his oligarchs that own Donald Trump. Back in season one, I talked to Asha Rangappa. She's a former FBI special agent who now teaches at Yale and talks about intelligence and the law on CNN. One of the things we discussed was the question of whether Trump was acting in Russia's interest because he was compromised, because Putin had something on him. She said it could be something even worse.
I think a witting asset is about as close as you come to kind of criminal conspiracy, right? It involves a certain knowledge that you are, in fact, furthering the, you know, national interest of, you know, another foreign government. And I think the problem that you have with this entire Trump cast is that they are so deeply corrupt that they can be enticed to do things merely based on ambition and greed and, you know, kind of narcissistic, like, incentives. A witting asset requires a certain moral orientation of some kind, because you do have to walk someone from the path of A to B, of I shouldn't do this, and here, you know, then you walk them to the path of, oh my God, I'm committing treason.
So if season one was about showing that Trump was a Russian asset, season two is about why he's a Russian asset. It's because he's corrupt. This season was about a man who is corrupt through and through. In season one, we talked about the potential depths of collusion. In this season, we've talked about the potential depths of the corruption. Frankly, there is no bottom to it. In the second episode of this season, we broke down all the schemes. There were endless permutations. And since recording that episode, we've learned more about them. Lev Parnas now appears to be cooperating. More charges are likely coming. And Rudy, it turns out, was also trying to make a quick buck from the Ukrainians on the side. What was revealed with Ukraine extortion scheme was just one narrow window into the corruption. But man, there is without a doubt so much more here. Remember when Michael Cohen took millions of dollars from a whole bunch of different companies, including a South Korean aerospace company, AT&T, and a firm tied to a Russian oligarch for vague lobbying work that pretty clearly was just an effort to get close to Trump? Well, of course you didn't. There's just so much to keep track of. And that's because this is fundamentally a criminal presidency. At the end of the day, this is what makes Trump so dangerous to American democracy. He is so thoroughly corrupt that his own personal interests are all that matter. Whatever helps him, whatever advances his interests, he will do. There are no rules, no boundaries, there is no bottom. He is a lawless president, and impeachment is the process embedded in the Constitution to hold someone like that accountable. Impeachment, therefore, has forced a reckoning. Do you support the rule of law or not? Do you support a corrupt Russian asset or not? There are no halfsies or squishy positions like I support Trump's policies but not his comments. Now Republicans have to stand up and make a choice. This is why it matters. We will now know who supports American democracy and who doesn't. No more talking around Trump. This is about Trump and the future of America. So we are concluding the season before the story is ended, before the final vote takes place in the House, and before the Senate trial. Many are confidently predicting that the Republican wall will hold, that Trump will be impeached on a party line vote and will be exonerated by a party line vote in the Senate, that there's no possible way 67 senators will vote to convict Donald Trump. This is probably the most likely outcome, but history shows us that life is unpredictable. It wasn't clear that there were votes to impeach Nixon until the House Judiciary Committee voted, and then Nixon suddenly resigned. We simply don't know how things will turn out. The future isn't written. Yes, there are real structural reasons to doubt the Republican Party will crack, to doubt that Trump will be removed. There's unprecedented partisanship that incentivizes Republicans to stick together. But history is full of surprises, of acts of courage that change the course of history. I tend to think of the impeachment process much like a democratic uprising, such as the Maidan Revolution that we talked about in Ukraine, where people took to the square. And when that's happened, whether it's in Maidan or in Tiananmen Square or in Tahrir Square or at the Berlin Wall in 1989, in all of those cases, you would probably place a bet against the protest succeeding. It's incredibly long odds to actually topple government or force dramatic change. These movements are often crushed by force. They're squeezed by arrest. They're sapped of energy. Look at the green movement in Iran, or the protests in Venezuela, or the protests in Moscow. But you know, sometimes they do succeed. The pressure builds and builds, then suddenly, out of nowhere, the dam breaks. The regime collapses. Because regimes that are held together by fear are brittle, and they can collapse dramatically. Because all it takes is for a regime's henchmen to fear the uprising more than the regime itself. Egypt fell this way, the Yanukovych government in Ukraine. Yet the savvy bet, the smart bet, is that these efforts, is that these protests will fail, that the regime will survive. But sometimes we have to remember these efforts succeed. We don't know what the future holds, but many Republicans in Congress have very little love for President Trump. They're held together by fear, and regimes held together by fear can collapse in an instant. The key is keeping the pressure on. And at this point, if one or two Republicans broke and came out for impeachment and voted for it, it would be a huge surprise and could shift the momentum, impacting Senate dynamics. Trump could also be caught in another scandal. Rudy could be arrested. This is why you keep the pressure on. You force Republicans to take a stand, and if they stand with Trump, well, then you decide it at the ballot box. But no matter what, moving forward to impeach Trump for his crimes, for his corruption, was essential, because it showed the country and the world that this is not okay, that we aren't going to let American democracy, the rule of law, go quietly into the night. There will be a fight, and maybe he won't be removed, but he will be the third president in the history of the United States to be impeached by the House of Representatives. And so we will go into 2020 with this being an election for the future of American democracy, with this being an election about Donald Trump, where our corrupt president who has corrupted a party that backs him no matter what would be returned to office. Every election in my lifetime has been deemed the most important, but this time it's actually true. When we concluded the last season, we talked about how democracies die, about how we have become normalized to Trump, to his illegality, to his corruption. We must resist that. We must not become normalized to this. And impeachment is part of the antidote to normalization. It says no. It says nyet. This is not okay. It hits back on the normalization. If Trump survives impeachment, like he survived the Mueller report, and we are faced with the prospect of a lawless president backed by the Kremlin and Vladimir Putin, who wants nothing more to discredit American democracy, running for re-election, it will be the most important election of our lifetimes, perhaps in the history of the country. And the future of our democracy will be on the ballot. I'm Max Bergman, and this has been The Asset.
The Asset is a production of the Center for American Progress Action Fund, Protect the Investigation, and District Productive. Paul Woody Woodhull, Max Bergman, executive producers, and Peter Ogburn, senior producer. The Asset is written by Max Bergman and the good people at the Moscow Project, Jeremy Vanook, Talia Dessel, and Sienna Ciccarelli. And the team at Protect the Investigation and Paul Woody Woodhull and his cohort at District Productive. To learn more about Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election, go to the themoscowproject.org and protecttheinvestigation.org. Please subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. And please leave a rating and a review. Thank you.
Impeachment is about cleansing the office. Impeachment is about restoring honor and integrity to the office.